Section 4.10, National Strategic Security. Before we can abolish war, we need to understand it. Peter Turkin. Section 4.10.1, Modeling How Modern Agrarian Society Controls Its Resources. It is possible to model warfare as a resource control protocol. Sections 4.5 through 4.7 discuss the differences between abstract power and physical power-based resource control systems. These sections discussed how agrarian society attempts to use abstract power to replace physical power. The word attempt was emphasized because abstract power-based resource control structures clearly tend to break down. If abstract power functioned properly as the basis for managing resources, there wouldn't be so many physical conflicts. The fact that wars break out suggests that abstract power isn't the only thing that humans use to manage their resources, so we need to update our model. To produce a more accurate model to describe how agrarian society manages their resources, it is necessary to account for their use of physical power competitions, in other words, warfare. This can be accomplished by creating a resource control structure model, which incorporates both abstract power and physical power. To that end, a hybrid resource control model has been provided in Figure 52, a more accurate model of the resource control structure adopted by modern society. This model accounts for the fact that agrarian society attempts to use abstract power to manage the state of ownership and chain of custody of their resources, but routinely reverts back to using physical power. This model contains the same controllers as the previously described resource control models and combines them together into a single system. Three control actions worth the reader's attention have been enumerated and highlighted in purple. 1. Abstract power subscribes to physical power. 2. Physical power projectors constrain, decentralize, enforce, and legitimize abstract power. 3. Abstract power projectors request enforcement and legitimization from physical power projectors. The first control action is subscribe. As previously discussed, everyone tacitly subscribes to the control authority of physical power, by virtue of the fact that nobody gets to unsubscribe from the influence of physical power. No matter what belief systems people adopt, and no matter how people choose to design their abstract power hierarchies, nobody who wields abstract power gets to unsubscribe from the authority of physical power. As previously explained, physical power is unsympathetic. It works the same regardless of whether or not people believe in it or sympathize with it. This means our presidential republics, semi-presidential republics, parliamentary republics, constitutional monarchies, semi-constitutional monarchies, absolute monarchies, or one-party states are all equally subordinate to physical power and equally incapable of escaping its impact. For these reasons, physical power is placed above abstract power in this control structure model. The second control action worth special attention is constrain, decentralize, enforce, and legitimize. As discussed in this chapter, a primary value-delivered function of warfare is that it allows people to physically constrain and decentralize abstract power. Warfighting is the reason why control authority over Earth's dry land has been divided across 195 different abstract power hierarchies, what we now call countries. The precise boundaries of these abstract power hierarchies have been adjusted many times over the past several thousand years, but the control authority over Earth's resources has always remained globally decentralized, precisely because of physical power projection. In addition to physically constraining and decentralizing control authority over Earth's natural resources, physical power projectors, in other words, militaries, also legitimize the abstract power wielded by abstract power projectors. This references the concepts presented in section 4.5 and the example about how kings utilize the physical power projected by their knights to legitimize and convince people to believe in their own abstract power. By having physical power projectors project physical power within the same context of the king's assertion of abstract power, the imaginary power wielded by the king is easier to misperceive as concretely real. Technically speaking, this is a false positive correlation between an abstract input produced by the human imagination and a physical sensory input produced by a power projector. Nevertheless, it works at legitimizing abstract power. As many societies have proven time and time again through countless rebellions, revolutions, and coups d'etats, kings are physically powerless in shared objective physical reality. All it takes to undermine the abstract power and control authority of anyone with abstract power is to simply 1. Stop believing in their abstract power, or 2. Countervail the physical power of the king's physical power projectors. In other words, defeat the king's army, the people with real power. We know this process works because it is the reason why monarchies today are almost entirely ceremonial and have virtually no abstract power, one major exception being the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The reason why most monarchies today are almost entirely ceremonial is because power projectors stop legitimizing their abstract power. The populations living under monarchies in the past got so fed up with the exploitation and abuse of their belief system that they, 1. Stopped believing in the king's imaginary power, or 2. Started projecting real power to countervail their monarch's army, thus delegitimizing the king's abstract power. If kings truly had the power they claimed to have, this would not have happened. But a series of revolutionary wars made a very compelling case that kings don't have real power. They just have abstract power. For this reason, abstract power projectors have been placed in a lower and more subordinate position to physical power projectors in this model. The last enumerated control action is request, enforcement, and legitimization. This is another tacit control action that is easy to explain using the same king and knight example. When a king orders his army to carry out his will, what he is really doing is asking physical power projectors to legitimize his abstract power. The same thing happens during virtually any form of physical enforcement. Physical power is superior to abstract power, which means physical power projectors are superior to abstract power projectors. Additionally, laws are only imaginary logical constraints, not physical constraints. Because imaginary constraints are demonstrably incapable of physically preventing anyone from doing anything, laws must be physically legitimized using physical power. The request for physical legitimization and enforcement of abstract power is therefore implicit, not explicit, but nevertheless still a request. As many rulers have learned the hard way over many acts of mutiny, physical power projectors can and often do choose to stop enforcing or legitimizing their ruler's abstract power. When this happens, the control authority that abstract power projectors have over people's resources disappears. Conversely, when abstract power projectors choose not to legitimize physical power projectors, the control authority of physical power projectors does not change. For this and several other reasons, we know that abstract power projectors require the tacit permission of physical power projectors, and not the other way around. This cold, hard truth is backed by a well-recorded history of many rulers being physically overthrown. Section 4.10.2. Two ways for the oppressed to countervail both abstract and physical power projectors. Using this newly updated control structure design, we can see that it reveals two ways for members to escape oppression if they feel like they are in an abusive or exploitative resource control structure. If a member is being oppressed by either abstract or physical power projectors, regardless of whether those power projectors are from a neighboring country or from the member's own country, those members have two ways to countervail their control authority. The first way was originally mentioned in Section 3.11. Members can simply refuse to assign value to the resources being controlled. As an example, consider the US dollar, USD, world reserve currency. USD is an international resource controlled by an abstract power hierarchy backed by the world's most powerful power projectors, the US military. The US military legitimizes the abstract power of its presidential republic, and by virtue of the design logic encoded into their rules of law, that presidential republic has executive control authority over USD. While it is certainly true that both types of power projectors, the abstract power of the presidential republic plus the physical power of the US military, have control authority over the state of ownership and chain of custody of USD, that doesn't make anyone have to value USD. Therein lies the key to countervailing US power. Hypothetically speaking, if the US were to forget how this power structure works and became systemically exploitative and abusive with their control authority over USD, for example, if they started denying people's access to USD through sanctions, or debasing people's purchasing power by inflating USD, then members could countervail both the physical and abstract power of the US by simply not valuing USD as their world reserve currency anymore. For this reason, the assign value to resources control action which members can exercise seems small, but it is in fact very empowering. If the people in charge of the USD were to do something which motivated members to exercise this control action and stop valuing USD, their abstract power and control authority would disappear. It is therefore critical for the US not to do anything to motivate members from exercising this control action, else they risk losing their power. The US deliberately made themselves vulnerable to this attack vector by converting USD from a physical system into an abstract belief system in the 1970s. Like so many organizations to come before them, the US seems to have lost sight of the value of physical constraints to abstract power. By converting USD into a money denominated by gold, into a money denominated purely by bits of information, aka fiat, the US converted their entire monetary system into an abstract belief system with no physical constraints securing it against systemic exploitation by high-ranking people who control the transfer and storage of those bits of information. Additionally, the people with abstract power and control authority over USD only have it insofar as people are willing to believe in it, because physical power is irrelevant at securing money which doesn't physically exist. So not only do members have the freedom to choose not to assign value to USD, they also have the freedom to choose not to recognize the abstract power and control authority of the people who control USD. This means the entire USD monetary resource control system is backed by nothing but the faith in the value of the dollar and the abstract power of the people who control the dollar. Of course, people can quickly lose their faith at any time, so it's imperative for the US not to do anything to motivate people to lose their faith in USD, which means it's imperative for the US not to deny people's access to USD or to degrade its purchasing power. Yet, in fiat form, there's nothing to physically constrain the US from doing either of these things. These power dynamics put the people who have control over USD on thin ice, and make it especially important for them to have the discipline not to deny people's access to USD or degrade its purchasing power. These people must be careful not to do anything to cause the people to lose faith in their imaginary power, because if they do, their abstract power and control authority over this valuable abstract resource could quickly evaporate no matter how physically powerful the United States is. This same principle applies to virtually any form of non-essential resource. For example, many people use both physical and abstract power to control the state of ownership and chain of custody of diamonds. Both physical and abstract power over diamonds can be made obsolete by simply not valuing diamonds. There are, of course, some essential resources which sapiens don't have the option of not valuing. For example, food, water, and oxygen. In cases where sapiens don't have the option of escaping oppression by choosing not to value resources, their second option to regain control authority over the state of ownership and chain of custody of their resources is to become their own physical power projectors and impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on their oppressors. This is a primary motivation behind wars. Because physical power is inegalitarian and inclusive, anyone can choose to become a physical power projector regardless of their rank or title or standing within the existing abstract power hierarchy. Section 4.10.3, The National Strategic Security Dilemma. Now that we have made a general model of agrarian society's resource control structure, we can review the topic of national strategic security. Members of abstract power hierarchies have two primary vulnerabilities: foreign invasion or internal corruption. The former usually occurs when a foreign belligerent actor uses physical power as the basis for their attack. The latter usually occurs when a belligerent actor uses abstract power as the basis for their attack. Either way, both vulnerabilities have the same solution: impose severe physical costs on the attacker until they don't have the capacity or inclination to continue their attack. Based on this insight, we can see that the same primordial economic dynamics which apply to wild organisms and organizations also apply to agrarian society. This makes perfect sense considering how agrarian society is quite literally a pack of wild animals, just like any other pack animal species observed in nature. We can therefore describe the dynamics of national strategic security the same way we described the survivor's dilemma in the previous chapter. Like any other wild organism in nature, every nation has a benefit-to-cost ratio of attack, BCRA. A nation's BCRA is a simple fraction determined by two variables, the benefit of attacking it and the cost of attacking it. Benefit of attack is a function of how much resource abundance and control authority is offered by a nation's abstract power hierarchy. Nations with large economies, high levels of resource abundance, and substantial amounts of control authority over those resources have a higher benefit of attack. On the flip side of the equation, cost of attack is a function of how capable a nation is at imposing severe, physically prohibitive costs on attackers. Nations with populations who are more capable of and inclined to impose physically prohibitive costs on attackers have a higher cost of attack. Nations which survive and prosper are those which manage both sides of their BCRA equation effectively. To prevent their BCRA from climbing to hazardous levels, nations must either shrink the numerator, benefit of attack, or grow the denominator, cost of attack, of their BCRA equation. They must either shrink their economy and control authority to decrease their benefit of attack, or they must grow their cost of attack by increasing their capacity and inclination to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on attackers. Decreasing the size of a nation's economy is not an ideal solution, so growing cost of attack is the preferable option. If nations choose to grow their economy without growing their cost of attack at an equal or higher rate, then the rate at which their benefit of attack increases, BCRA, will climb. This explains why pacifism, in other words, a decrease in a nation's inclination to use physical power to impose physically prohibitive costs on attackers, is such a systemic security threat. The more pacifist a nation becomes, the higher their BCRA will climb, and the more likely they are to be devoured by predators, either in the form of foreign invasion or internal corruption. To achieve long-term survival, nations must keep their BCRA level lower than the hazardous BCRA level of the surrounding environment. In other words, the BCRA level which would motivate belligerents to attack. The space in between a nation's BCRA level and the hazardous BCRA level can be called its prosperity margin. This margin indicates how much a nation can afford for its BCRA to rise before it risks being attacked. Figure 53, illustration of the national strategic security dilemma, provides an illustration of the resulting national strategic security dilemma. Note, this is exactly the same figure as figure 16, except with a different name. As a nation's economy becomes stronger and more resource abundant, its benefit of attack increases. This causes the nation's BCRA to increase and get closer to the environment's hazardous BCRA level. As a nation's BCRA level approaches the hazardous level, their prosperity margin shrinks. This creates an unfavorable dynamic where the more successful a nation becomes, the more vulnerable it is to either foreign invasion or internal corruption. To make matters even more challenging, a nation cannot know for sure how much prosperity margin it has, nor how quickly it's shrinking. This is because nobody can truly know what the hazardous BCRA level is, as it is a probabilistic phenomenon which depends on the capacity and inclination to project physical power of neighboring nations and is therefore completely outside of a nation's individual control. All a nation can know about their environment's hazardous BCRA level is that it will continuously drop as the environment becomes increasingly congested, contested, competitive, and hostile. The national strategic security dilemma puts all nations into a predicament where they have the same three response options described in the previous chapter. Option one is to do nothing to counterbalance the effect of their increasing benefit of attack. The upside to this strategy is that it is more energy efficient. This is because the population effectively ignores its security responsibilities. The downside of this strategy is that it causes the nation's BCRA to continue rising ad infinitum, shrinking prosperity margin until the point where the nation is virtually guaranteed to be invaded or internally corrupted. Options 2 and 3 represent strategies where a population doesn't ignore their security responsibilities and uses physical power to impose severe physical costs on attackers. In other words, increasing their cost of attack. The difference between option 2 and option 3 is that option 2 only grows cost of attack at the same rate as the benefit of attack grows, causing the nation's BCRA to remain fixed. Unfortunately, this will still cause prosperity margin to continue shrinking because it does not account for the fact that the environment's hazardous BCRA level continuously falls as it becomes increasingly congested, contested, competitive, and hostile. Option 3 remedies this flaw by endeavoring to increase the cost of attack faster than the benefit of attack grows, causing BCRA to fall and prosperity margin to grow. Assuming the nation succeeds at increasing their cost of attack fast enough to outpace their environment's falling hazardous BCRA level. Not surprisingly, the best strategic move a nation can make to solve the national strategic security dilemma is the same move any living organisms or organization can make to solve the survivor's dilemma, option 3. As illustrated by the agrarian fossil record and thousands of years of written testimony by survivors, if an agrarian population wants to survive and prosper, they need to endeavor to master their capacity and inclination to project physical power so they can continuously increase their cost of attack and buy themselves as much prosperity margin as possible. This creates a national strategic shelling point for all nations to vector a portion of their resources towards increasing their cost of attack. Unfortunately, this shelling point causes the surrounding environment to become increasingly more contested, competitive, and hostile, causing the environment's hazardous BCRA level to fall faster. This creates a self-reinforcing feedback loop, which makes it increasingly more imperative for nations to continue increasing their cost of attack and lowering their BCRA as much as they can afford to do so. The emergent effect of this self-reinforcing feedback loop is the same as what we observe in nature. Agrarian societies grow in size and scale, organizing in larger and increasingly clever ways, and develop increasingly clever power projection tactics. They focus much of their time, attention, and resources on discovering and adopting dual-use power projection tactics, which help them manage both sides of their BCRA equation, just like the behavior observed with the evolution of life. Just as these dynamics explain why nature's top surviving wild animals are often fierce-looking and tough, they also explain why the most successful nations with the best-performing economies often have the largest and most successful militaries. Eventually, this power projection game scales into what we see today, with massive-scale militaries and extraordinary power projection capabilities. Thus, the same dynamics which explain power projection in nature simultaneously offer us a simple explanation for how and why behaviorally modern sapiens scaled their physical power projection capacity to the point of risking nuclear annihilation. Section 4.11. Mutually Assured Destruction. Because of your leader's refusal to accept the surrender declaration that would enable Japan to honorably end this useless war, we have employed our atomic bomb. Before we use this bomb again to destroy every resource of the military by which they are prolonging this useless war, petition the Emperor now. Act at once, or we shall resolutely employ this bomb and all our other superior weapons to promptly and forcefully end the war. U.S. warning leaflets dropped on Japanese cities following the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. Section 4.11.1. Cooperate or Die. Anthropologists like Peter Turkin have outlined a compelling case that more than 10,000 years of warfighting have produced enough data to indicate a causally inferable relationship between warfighting and the size and scale of human cooperation. He asserts that sapiens became the world's greatest cooperators as a direct result of the existential imperative caused by agrarian warfighting. Additionally, thanks to their increasingly higher levels of cooperation, less of the human population is required to participate in warfighting. To support this theory, Turkin developed a methodology to measure the size and scale of human cooperation and trace how the number of people in polities has grown since the dawn of the Neolithic Age, which he then compared to the proliferation of miscellaneous warfighting technologies. He was able to build a model which accurately predicts the size, scale, and time of human civilization's growth based on nothing more than the development and proliferation of their warfighting technologies. The model accurately predicts where and when the largest, most cooperative, and most prosperous human societies reigned. Based on experiments like this and other forms of cultural evolutionary analysis, Turkin argues that there could be a causal relationship between warfare and cooperation, which drove human cooperation to scales far exceeding the largest colonies of organisms observed in the wild, even in comparison to organisms which are famous for having highly cooperative colonies, like ants and termites. Turkin also argues that warfare creates a counterintuitively positive dynamic of creative destruction, where agrarian society channels its resources to the most stable, cooperative, and productive societies capable of sustaining high-functioning cooperative relationships for the longest amounts of time. In other words, warfare creates trickle-up dynamics where natural resources flow to the most well-organized and cooperative civilizations. While Turkin's theory may be novel from an anthropological perspective, it should not be surprising to anyone who can understand the core concepts of power projection in nature and the innovate, cooperate, or die dynamics of predation discussed in the previous chapter. It is incontrovertibly true that living organisms have been evolving into increasingly more organized, cooperative, and innovative creatures as a direct response to the existential threat of predation, since at least the first bacteria discovered phagocytosis, the capacity to subsume or eat other bacteria. As discussed in the previous chapter about power projection tactics in nature, cooperation is first and foremost a power projection tactic which emerged at least as early as 2 billion years ago. To project more power and make it harder to justify the physical cost of attacking them, organisms simply sum their individual physical power together using cooperation. The concept is very simple, but quite difficult to execute, especially on large scales. The simple truth of the matter is that teamwork is hard. It's extraordinarily difficult to get a bunch of organisms to trust each other and work together effectively to mutually increase their cost of attack and lower their BCRA. Cooperation requires pack animals to come up with solutions for very challenging questions, and one of the most difficult challenges they face is the existentially important challenge of establishing a pecking order. In a world filled with predators, entropy, and limited resources, where organisms must learn how to cooperate to survive, who gets feeding and breeding rights? What's the best way to divvy up the pack's limited resources to ensure they have the best chances for survival as a team, rather than as individuals? A repeating theme of this chapter is that there's no reason to believe sapiens are a special exception to the same struggles faced by other organisms in nature. It would be difficult to make the argument that sapient organizations wouldn't benefit from the same trend of predation in precisely the same way as wild animals from which they evolved, a way that's quite simple to empirically validate by spending some time outside observing wild animals. It seems natural that sapiens would learn that the best way to survive against predators and entropy is to cooperate together at increasingly higher scales. Sapiens would also experience the same cooperation challenges. Therefore, does it make sense to believe that humans wouldn't adopt the same pecking order strategy that practically all other organisms with the same problem have adopted? Why wouldn't humans feed and breed the most physically powerful and aggressive members of their tribe if that's what pack animals have independently verified as an ideal survival strategy? If the reader has made it this far, then you have a deep-seated appreciation for how sapiens have attempted to deal with the pecking order problem differently than other animals. Instead of using might is right or feed and breed the physically powerful first as their pecking order strategy, sapiens use their imagination to come up with abstract pecking orders where people with imaginary power get first dibs rather than the people with real power. Why exactly is that? The author has now offered two potential explanations. The first was because it uses less energy, and the second was because it's less physically destructive. However, here Turkin provides another viable explanation, because it scales human cooperation. There is theoretically no limit to how many people can choose to believe in the same thing. Thus, there's theoretically no limit to how far an abstract power hierarchy can expand its control over resources. As long as people are willing to adopt the same belief system, there's no limit to how far humans scale their cooperation. For all we know, there could have already been a galactic-scale empire long ago in a galaxy far, far away that figured out how to scale their cooperation to the galactic level. The takeaway is that abstract power hierarchies have essentially zero marginal cost to scale, Because belief systems are essentially free to adopt. Because abstract power hierarchies represent nothing more than a belief system, all it takes to build an abstract power hierarchy is simply to share an idea. For sapiens, the cooperate or die dynamics of survival turn into believe in this idea or die. Therefore, out of existential necessity and for the sake of self-preservation, particularly in response to the threat of invasion, sapiens are compelled to adopt increasingly larger scale belief systems because if they don't, they're much less likely to survive against other sapiens who adopt increasingly larger scale belief systems. This dynamic appears to be what led agrarian society towards adopting massive scale belief systems like nation states, as well as the national power alliances formed by multiple nation states, for example, the European Union or NATO. 200,000 years ago, humans traveled in foraging bands comprised of tens of people. 10,000 years ago, sapient populations increased to farming villages comprised of hundreds of people. 7,500 years ago, sapiens developed simple chiefdoms, small cities, comprised of thousands of people. 7,000 years ago, these simple chiefdoms turned into complex chiefdoms, comprised of tens of thousands of people. 5,000 years ago, the first archaic states emerged and were comprised of hundreds of thousands of people. 500 years after that, human cooperation exploded into macro states comprised of millions of people. 2,500 years ago, the first mega empires emerged, comprised of tens of millions of people. Remarkably, the large nation states we live in today are merely 200 years old. Abstract power hierarchies clearly have the ability to scale quickly because ideas have essentially no marginal cost. This makes them a useful countermeasure against nations attempting to scale their physical power projection capabilities. Abstract power hierarchies help humans coordinate their efforts better, assuming the people with abstract power are competent and trustworthy. And due to the constant existential threat of warfare, humans are forced into accepting these belief systems where people have imaginary power over them, because they need high levels of cooperation to survive in a world filled with predators and entropy. These dynamics imply that sapiens are placed into a strategic pickle where they must choose which abstract power hierarchy they want to subscribe to, or else they will find themselves fending for themselves alone in the wild. Except, our Paleolithic ancestors weren't helpless in the wild. They had the freedom and confidence to roam the continents hunting and gathering. They didn't have to worry about massive-scale nuclear-armed tribes run by dictators on abstract power trips. Turkin's anthropological theory is a straightforward argument which matches biological theory quite nicely. His theories seem intuitive to people who study nature with scientific and amoral rigor, but it can be unintuitive to domesticated sapiens who have adopted the habit of believing they're above the routine physical confrontation observed in nature, or believing that physical conflict and aggression, both of which are very common behaviors observed in every size, scale, and corner of the wild and rewarded by natural selection, is immoral according to whatever their individually subjective and unfalsifiable definition of what moral is. If we were to combine these concepts with the core concepts presented in the previous chapter about power projection in nature, then we can see how the emergent behavior of agrarian society is precisely the same as primordial economic dynamics observed in evolutionary biology. This means we can summarize the complex emergent behavior of national strategic security and the phenomenon of using warfighting using simple bow tie notation. To that end, Figure 54 shows a bow tie representation of national strategic security dynamics. Here, the author illustrates how it's possible to boil the complex dynamics of 10,000 years of agrarian warfighting down to a simple little illustration where organisms pair up with other organisms and adopt increasingly larger scale abstract power hierarchies so they can increase their ability to impose physical costs on neighboring organizations, all for the sake of surviving and prospering in a congested, contested, competitive, and hostile environment filled with predators and entropy. The top portion of this figure shows individual nations projecting national power. Each nation has their own individual benefit of attack and cost of attack, and thus their own individual BCRA. To increase their ability to survive against predators and entropy, they learn how to organize and cooperate and sum their cost of attack together, as shown in the top right portion of the figure. By summing their cost of attack together, they create a shelling point where other nations must sum their cost of attack together, or else their individual BCRA will be too high. Fast forward these dynamics across thousands of years, and we arrive at the situation shown in the bottom of this figure, where alliances of individual nations double as organizations in and of themselves, for example, NATO, comprised of billions of people endlessly searching for increasingly clever ways to project power, sum it together, and use it as a mechanism to make it impossible for adversaries to justify the cost of a fight. So there you have it. Sapiens are exactly the same as any other multicellular organisms, learning how to stick together through colonization or clustering. Like Archaon, little sapient conquerors go around capturing cities, forcing them to stick together, and turning them into nation-states. A few generations pass, and another sapient conqueror goes around capturing city-states, forcing them to stick together, and turning them into nation-states. Each time this happens, the pressurized membrane surrounding each city-state, in other words, their militarily enforced borders, grows larger and stronger, increasing their capacity to project power. Under the mutually beneficial security of these increasingly powerful borders, colonies of clustered humans grow increasingly more interdependent and reliant on each other for vital nutrients, materials, and gene swapping. They are able to form highly complex structures, self-assembling into increasingly more specialized workforces, trading various goods and services, and becoming ever more efficient, productive, and resource abundant. Through this special combination of robust security and high-functioning internal economy, sapiens were able to follow a multi-step biological path towards ever-increasing structure until it managed to self-assemble into complex, massive-scale economies we see today. Section 4.11.2. Warfare is a self-perpetuating process that naturally increases in size and destructive power. A primary takeaway from Turkin's theory on the relationship between warfare and cooperation is that humans are compelled out of existential necessity to adopt common abstract belief systems, which make them more capable of cooperating and combining their power projection capabilities together for mutual survival and prosperity. Expanding on Turkin's theory, it's possible to make two follow-on observations. The first observation is described in this section. The second observation is described in the next section. First, the size and asymmetry of modern agrarian abstract power hierarchies, in other words, governments, appear to be a direct result of human warfighting. This is a subtle but remarkable observation to make because it implies that warfare is its own root cause. If Turkin's theory is valid, then we can thank the existential stress of warfare for being a reason why abstract power hierarchies have more asymmetric power and control authority over valuable resources than ever before. But at the same time, we also know that dysfunctional abstract power hierarchies are one of the primary motivations behind warfare. Add these two insights together, and we can generate a profound observation that the root cause of warfare is the emergent effect of warfare. In other words, warfare causes itself. Warfare creates an existential imperative for people to adopt increasingly larger, and thus more dysfunctional and vulnerable to systemic exploitation, abstract power hierarchies, which create increasingly larger security hazards capable of leading to increasingly larger losses. Dysfunctional abstract power hierarchies motivate people to wage wars, which are won by adopting larger scale abstract power hierarchies, for example, national power alliances, to scale cooperation and sum enough physical power to win the war. This creates a cyclical, self-perpetuating process where civilization learns to cooperate at higher scales, but also learns to fight at increasingly larger and more destructive scales, driving them to adopt increasingly more systemically insecure and hazardous belief systems. Through this spiral, what starts as a comparatively minor territorial dispute over irrigated land between Neolithic chiefdoms hurling spears at each other snowballs into modern nation-states pointing nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles at each other, which is now expanding extraterrestrially into space and cislunar orbit. If the author's description of national strategic security dynamics is accurate, then it's quite ironic. It means that even though agrarian society uses warfare to physically constrain and decentralize abstract power hierarchies and prevent the world from falling under the rule of a single ruling class, the emergent effect of that activity causes the size of agrarian society's abstract power hierarchies to grow and gain asymmetrically higher amounts of control authority over everyone, making populations increasingly more vulnerable to systemic exploitation from their own ruling classes. To put it more simply, in our attempts to physically constrain and decentralize our neighbor's ruling class so they can't exploit us with their imaginary power and resource control authority, we inadvertently make ourselves more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse from our own ruling class. By winning world wars against our neighbors, we create massive-scale abstract power hierarchies with extraordinarily asymmetric amounts of abstract power and control authority over our most valuable resources, thus high BCRA, and we attract systemic predators like moths to a flame. We practically lay down a red carpet for predators and invite them to come systemically exploit the common belief systems we have to adopt to win our wars, which inevitably causes our belief systems to break down and lead to more war. It's a vicious, tragic cycle. Section 4.11.3. Nation-states are an untested multicellular organism living in the wild. A second follow-on observation from Turkin's theory is that nation-states are relatively untested in nature. For 99.9% of the time that anatomically modern sapiens have walked the Earth, they have not lived in nation-states. For 99.6% of the time that behaviorally modern sapiens have been thinking abstractly and constructing shared imaginary ideological constructs for themselves, they have not believed in nation-states. Abstract power hierarchies have been around for thousands of years, but these abstract power hierarchies have never been large enough to qualify as nation-states, and have never been as asymmetrically powerful, thus as systemically insecure, as they are today. We feel like nation-states have been around forever, because enough time has passed where we, and all the people we have ever met, have only ever lived in a world governed by abstract power hierarchies large enough to qualify as nation-states. But comparatively speaking, nation-states are very new, and we don't know if they're a properly functioning, long-term survival strategy for our species. Nation-states have clear, systemic security flaws. They inherit all the flaws of abstract power hierarchies discussed at length in this chapter, and then magnify them to unprecedented scale. It is incontrovertibly true that people who are given asymmetric abstract power and control authority over people's valuable resources can't be trusted not to exploit or abuse that abstract power. Based on that same written testimony, we also know that it is incontrovertibly true that attempting to logically constrain abstract power by encoding rules of law are demonstrably inefficient. Nevertheless, modern agrarian society has scaled this repeatedly dysfunctional belief system to the point where hundreds of millions of people, even billions of people in cases like China, must trust hundreds of people not to exploit their abstract power and control authority over the population's most valuable resources. Why would people agree to this? If Turkin's theory is valid, it's because it's existentially necessary for survival. This would imply that modern agrarian society effectively backed itself into a corner with another strategic shelling point. We must adopt massive-scale abstract power hierarchies because it's the only way to survive against our neighbors' massive-scale abstract power hierarchies. But as a result of adopting these massive-scale abstract power hierarchies, we entrap ourselves. Are nation-states really a good idea for agrarian society in the long term? How can we know? Nation-states didn't emerge until the last 0.1% of our anatomically modern time here on Earth. Our nation-states and their corresponding national power alliances are practically untested belief systems. We don't yet know how well they will enable sapiens to survive in the wild, particularly survival against ourselves. It's possible they could backfire on us just like so many other emergent power projection tactics have backfired on other life forms over the past several billion years. We can't yet know if these types of abstract power hierarchies can function properly at this scale because we don't have enough data to know yet. However, we do have enough data to conclude that at smaller scales, abstract power hierarchies are highly prone to exploitation and abuse. Why are they so vulnerable? Because metacognition. Because humans live according to their abstract thoughts and imaginations and symbolic knowledge, not according to experiential knowledge or what they can gain from shared objective physical reality. Abstract power hierarchies are fundamentally belief systems, and all sapiens are vulnerable to psychological exploitation and abuse of their belief system. Sapiens can, and routinely do, allow themselves to be systemically exploited in, from, and through their belief systems, especially when those belief systems involve highly asymmetric amounts of abstract power and control authority over valuable resources. So far, all we have to go on to determine if nation-states are a good idea is a statistically irrelevant sample of about 200 years worth of data. That data is inconclusive to say the least. It's filled with many of the best examples of sapient aspiration and achievement that would never have been possible if it weren't for the extraordinarily high scales of cooperation that nation-states enabled. Through the cooperation and coordination of our nation-states, we walk on the moon and build international space stations. But at the exact same time, we carpet bomb cities and drop nuclear warheads on them. Many of the worst examples of destruction ever experienced by sapiens have occurred in the past 200 years. Section 4.11.4. Like cyanobacteria, sapiens may have discovered a new type of bounded prosperity trap. Nevertheless, no matter what our opinions about nation-states are, they're essentially irrelevant to the subject of security. Nation-states may be a few hundred years old, but the first principles dynamics of security are billions of years old. National security is therefore the same physical power projection game that has been played for billions of years, but with a different name and different branding. This makes national security a very straightforward process. If you want to know how to be good at national security, simply study nature and observe the behavior of nature's top survivors. To be good at national security, make your own nation better organized, cooperative, and innovative, so that it can find increasingly clever ways to project physical power against neighbors to increase the cost of attack and decrease BCRA. Like many other types of organisms in the wild, nations must strive to continually evolve if they want to keep themselves secure against predators and entropy. The more they can continually increase their capacity to impose severe physical costs on neighboring nations in increasingly clever ways, the more they can make it impossible to justify the cost of attacking them. The more a nation can make it impossible to justify the cost of attacking them, the more prosperity margin it can buy for its internal population. At scale, this survival strategy produces the same dynamics discussed in Section 3.8, where nations must chase after infinite prosperity by continually searching for new and innovative ways to increase the cost of attacking them ad infinitum. It should be no surprise that this process led agrarian civilization right to the brink of nuclear annihilation. In the previous chapter, the author discussed how organisms sometimes struggle to find increasingly clever power projection tactics, techniques, and technologies, making them incapable of countervailing predators and entropy. The author named this situation a bounded prosperity trap. One of the most dramatic examples of a bounded prosperity trap was the example provided about life's mass extinction event called the Great Oxygenation Event. As a refresher, cyanobacteria discovered an innovative tactic called photosynthesis, but it backfired on them by covering the world with highly combustible oxygen and setting themselves and the oceans ablaze for millions of years. Fortunately, life had the ingenuity to learn how to, literally, stick together and cooperate at increasingly higher scales. Organisms continually experimented with different types of power projection tactics until they were able to discover the right countermeasures needed to countervail the blaze and escape their fiery hell. This was perhaps the most compelling display of life's rebellious, do not go quietly into the night ethos against the cold and unsympathetic nature of the universe. Entropy quite literally lit a flame under life's hindquarters, and life responded not by giving up, but by becoming stronger and more intelligent and more powerful than it had ever been before. Cyanobacteria crawled out of their fiery hellscape by innovating, and they exited their bounded prosperity trap with multicellular membranes and many other innovations, to which we owe our everlasting gratitude today, billions of years later. With the concept of bounded prosperity traps fresh in mind, let's examine the state of the world today. The author asserts that life appears to have found its way into yet another bounded prosperity trap. This time, sapiens sprung the trap and placed much of life on Earth into yet another fiery hellscape, a perpetual state of global-scale agrarian warfare, and now a looming threat of nuclear extinction. Herein lies a core hypothesis of the author's theory on soft war, grounded in theoretical concepts from biology, psychology, anthropology, political science, game theory, and systems security theory. Section 4.11.5. A recurring contributing factor to warfare is the hubris to believe it isn't necessary. With extraordinary hubris, sapiens appear to believe they can outsmart natural selection and find a viable alternative to physical power for settling disputes, managing internal resources, and establishing a pecking order using nothing more than their imaginations. They linked their prefrontal cortices together through storytelling and adopted imaginary points of view where physical power isn't needed to settle their disputes, manage their internal resources, and establish their pecking order. They made faulty design assumptions and adopted systemically exploitable belief systems where people with abstract power placed at the top of abstract power hierarchies are allowed to settle their disputes, control their resources, and decide the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of their most valuable property. Like cyanobacteria and photosynthesis, sapiens and their abstract power hierarchies were a remarkable innovation that helped them achieve unprecedented levels of resource abundance. But also like photosynthesis, sapient abstract power hierarchies literally backfired on them and set the world ablaze by creating an emergent phenomenon we call warfare. Now life appears to be on the precipice of yet another mass extinction event, where they must figure out a way to stick together if they want to escape this new bounded prosperity trap. By choosing to believe in abstract power and becoming over-reliant on abstract power hierarchies as an ostensibly peaceful alternative to settling their disputes, managing internal resources, and establishing their pecking order, the belief systems sapiens design to avoid warfighting appears to be a leading cause of warfighting. In yet another tragic example of irony, the human desire to avoid physical conflict to settle small-scale policy and property disputes repeatedly cascades into massive-scale physical conflicts. By trying to avoid the use of physical power as the basis to settle disputes and manage resources, sapiens use their oversized foreheads to adopt belief systems which make them vulnerable to exploitation and incapable of surviving in a congested, contested, competitive, and hostile environment filled with predators and entropy. In their attempts to avoid the energy expenditure and injury risk of human-on-human physical conflict, sapiens seem to inadvertently contribute to creating more of both. Some agrarian populations became so self-domesticated by their imaginations that they forfeit their capacity and inclination to project physical power altogether. Not surprisingly, a population which doesn't believe in using physical power because of ideological reasons is a population incapable of protecting themselves against invaders who don't share the same ideologies. Alternatively, these populations become so docile and unsuspecting that they allow themselves to be exploited on a massive scale through their own ideologies. As history has shown, many populations would sooner worship oppressive god kings who literally brand and herd them like domesticated animals than to project physical power to physically secure themselves and the property they value against systemic exploitation and abuse. In their desire for peace, they become oppressed. People keep thinking their laws will keep them secure. They keep subscribing to demonstrably flawed beliefs that logical constraints encoded into laws and signed by people with abstract power are sufficient enough at protecting them against systemic exploitation and abuse, and they inevitably find themselves entrapped in states of major inequality and oppression, with no ability to recognize the source of the trap, thus no hope of escaping it. They mentally ensnare themselves by believing that logical constraints are viable replacements to physical constraints as a mechanism for keeping themselves and their property secure. They make no effort to understand the difference between logical or physical constraints, nor the difference between imaginary power and real power, and they get devoured. Surviving societies which don't get devoured are the societies which figure out the source of their vulnerabilities, call their compatriots to take arms with them, and make it impossible to justify the physical cost of either physically invading them or systemically exploiting their belief system. They learn how to organize better, cooperate at larger scales, and invent innovative technologies to win their battles. When an endangered society fights off the threat of a neighboring abstract power hierarchy, it's called a war. When an endangered society fights off the threat of exploitation by their own abstract power hierarchy, then if they win, it's often called a revolutionary war. If they lose, it's often called a civil war. Either way, war is war. It's the same physical power projection game with a different name. There is nothing different happening in shared objective physical reality when people engage in physical power competitions and call it regular warfare, civil warfare, or revolutionary warfare. The same species uses the same physical power projection tactics, techniques, and technologies. The primary difference is the stories they tell, the abstract thoughts people use to motivate themselves to organize and impose severe physical costs on each other. In every war, the cause people fight for is often imaginary. People frequently fight for nothing more than a belief system. Trapped behind the cage of their overpowered, overreactive neocortices, sapiens construct abstract realities indistinguishable from physical reality, which are more meaningful and satisfying for them. Their imaginary mental models of the world become so important to them that they will gratefully line up and die for them. Their abstract thoughts completely overpower their instincts not to harm their own kind, and they commit unnatural and unprecedented amounts of intraspecies fratricide, gutting and mangling each other for the sake of good or God or government, because people can't seem to be able to come to global consensus about what these things mean or what the correct design for them is. And despite all this suffering, as much as people hate to admit it, warfare keeps resurfacing because it has complex emergent social benefits. At the same time, it clearly has major downsides because it creates a self-reinforcing dynamo of self-destruction and intraspecies fratricide, more so than any other species on Earth. The more societies go to war with each other, the more they must cooperate at higher scales by forming larger and more exploitable abstract power hierarchies. This cooperation allows them to sum more power together to accomplish extraordinary achievements like winning world wars and traveling through space. But the more they create asymmetric imaginary power and authority over larger amounts of resources, the more asymmetrically advantageous it becomes for self-serving sociopaths to exploit populations through these belief systems. The more people get exploited through their belief systems, the more motivated they become to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war once again, to restore society back to an acceptable state of systemic security. But the more people fight wars, the more they must cooperate at larger scales by creating larger abstract power hierarchies. This creates a larger window of opportunity to be systemically exploited at even larger scales, which must be resolved using larger scales of physical conflict to impose larger amounts of physically prohibitive costs on exploiting them. If this is starting to sound repetitive, that's intentional. The author is illustrating to the reader that war is not only cyclical, it's tragically predictable. On and on the dynamo of self-destruction turns, the same process with the same root causes, repeating itself ad infinitum and ad nauseam, snowballing over tens of thousands of years to the point where sapiens subscribe to belief systems which make it socially acceptable to bomb cities to secure themselves against the imaginary belief systems adopted by the people living in the cities being bombed. And what do these people believe? They believe there is a viable substitute to physical power as the basis for settling their disputes, establishing control authority over their resources, and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership of property. They believe there is a moral or ethical alternative to physical power, that we could live in peace so long as we let them decide what right means, give them asymmetric abstract power and control authority over our resources, and entrust them not to exploit it. New alliances are formed at increasingly remarkable levels of cooperation to win global-scale wars against self-serving sociopaths, only for those alliances to make larger populations more systemically vulnerable to future generations of self-serving sociopaths who wear lapel pins and shake their hands in the air as they tell stories and try to convince people they know what's right. People line up to subscribe to these belief systems and let themselves get exploited at unprecedented scale, so entrapped behind their abstract thoughts and imaginary realities that they won't stop it. Through their belief systems, billions of people allow themselves to be gaslighted and systemically exploited in broad daylight by increasingly brazen god-kings. Onwards, agrarian society stumbles over itself like brain-dead zombies, dead men walking towards larger, more devastating wars, until they finally hit the brink of thermonuclear annihilation and the shelling point known as mutually assured destruction. Imagine, instead of trying to replace physical power with abstract power, that people learn to accept there is no replacement for physical power, and we instead sought to replace kinetic power with electric power. If we could figure out a way to use non-kinetic, thus non-lethal, forms of warfare that still enabled global-scale strategic power competitions to settle disputes, manage resources, and establish a pecking order, then we might be able to break this cycle. If only there were a global-scale physical power projection technology out there, to which society had zero trust, egalitarian, and permissionless access. Enter Bitcoin. Section 4.11.6. Warfare could be described as a blockchain. Study war long enough and it starts to look as predictable as clockwork. The self-reinforcing feedback loop of flawed human belief systems are so reliable that it seems like we could set our watch to it. Populations adopt abstract power hierarchies to stop projecting physical power, causing their BCRA to increase beyond a safe threshold, creating opportunities where populations will revert back to their primordial instincts to either capture high BCRA resources or impose high physical costs on attackers. A lot of watts and lives will be expended until populations have sufficiently lowered their BCRA, settled their disputes, established control authority over their resources, and achieved consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of their property. A block of time will pass where people can enjoy a reprieve from this global-scale physical power competition. This reprieve is so revered, it's given a special name, peace. And then, when enough time has passed for people to become complacent, the population will forget how painfully predictable they are. Their BCRA will climb, the predators will return, and the whole process starts over again. These blocks of time link together linearly, forming a chain of time blocks, or a blockchain. The winners of this continuous global power competition are given the privilege of writing history, which is nothing more than a globally distributed ledger of information that keeps account of who has control of what and what the general state of consensus is regarding the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of the world's resources. This clockwork behavior of modern society is illustrated in Figure 55, how the cycle of war creates a blockchain. Countless people have been sent to early graves, warning future generations through bone trails dug up thousands of years later. Countless other warnings have been written into the pages of history by the survivors. For thousands of years, people of the past have been trying to warn the people of the future that something isn't working. Our belief systems are clearly flawed. They clearly don't work the way we wish they would. Countless times, people have proven through their actions that there is no viable substitute for physical power for any population who wants to live free from the threat of foreign invasion or who wants to remain systemically secure against the threat of corrupt, self-serving sociopaths who psychologically exploit and abuse people through their belief systems. In our extraordinary hubris, we believe we can do better, and we ignore the warnings of our predecessors. We keep scaling our beliefs about abstract power to the point where those beliefs become a clear and present danger to the survival and prosperity of our species. By convincing ourselves early in the Neolithic age that we are above nature, that we don't need physical power to establish our pecking order, we appear to have set ourselves on a path to destroy ourselves. We keep telling ourselves a lie that we don't have to spend the energy or risk injury to use physical power to establish our pecking order like the animals we domesticate. We keep avoiding fights when and where they should have happened, where the energy expenditure and injury would have been minimal. We keep kicking the can down the road, hoping to avoid the physical conflict for moral or ethical reasons, until the hazards blossom into such extraordinary levels of dysfunction and losses that it must be resolved using far more energy, causing far more destruction and injury. And now we appear to have backed ourselves right into a corner where it has become too costly to physically settle our biggest property and policy disputes. Section 4.12. Humans need antlers.
Peace. No peace.
The Alien from Independence Day. Section 4.12.1. Hitting a kinetic ceiling. Caught in a bounded prosperity trap, agrarian society appears to have reached the crescendo of this 10,000-year-long song by running it straight into a kinetic ceiling. In our endeavors to use an imaginary replacement to physical power as the basis for settling our disputes, managing our resources, and establishing our pecking order, we ironically seem to have scaled our capacity to impose physical costs on attackers to the point where it is no longer practically useful as a mechanism to keep our property and policy physically secure against systemic exploitation. Sapiens are extraordinarily clever and resourceful. They are constantly finding new and innovative ways to be faster and more efficient at solving their problems. One of agrarian society's biggest problems is the survivor's dilemma, also known as national strategic security. To solve this problem, sapiens are continually searching for increasingly clever and more efficient ways to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on others to make it impossible to justify the cost of attacking them. But there's a catch. It is theoretically possible for sapiens to become so efficient and resourceful at imposing severe, physically prohibitive costs on each other that it defeats its own purpose. The author asserts that this could be what happened with the invention of strategic nuclear warheads. The evolution of human physical power projection tactics can be visualized in graphs like Figure 56. Evolution of physical power projection technologies developed by agrarian society. Using two evaluation criteria. One, how efficient they are. And two, how much physical power they have the capacity to produce. The efficiency of a given physical power projection technology is a function of how much physical power it can project divided by the cost required to produce that power. Cost can be measured in several ways, to include money or casualties. The more efficient physical power projection technology is, the easier it becomes to project large quantities of power on a potential attacker to make it impossible to justify the cost of an attack. In other words, the more efficient power projection technology becomes, the better it becomes at growing its cost of attack, reducing BCRA, and buying prosperity margin for the nation utilizing that technology. Strategic nuclear warheads and deterrence policies like mutually assured destruction suggest it is possible to engineer physical power projection technologies that are so efficient they're not practically useful. If multiple nations have the means to place thermonuclear warheads in multiple independent re-entry vehicles sitting on top of intercontinental or even cislunar ballistic missiles, that suggests we have become so efficient at projecting kinetic physical power on each other that it represents an existential threat to the species. In yet another display of irony, human ingenuity appears to have made kinetic physical power so inexpensive to project, in terms of size, weight, matter, and monetary resources, that it has become too expensive to project, in terms of infrastructure destroyed and lives lost. In their quest to become more efficient at national security, humans appear to have accidentally created the most inefficient national security capability ever, strategic nuclear warfare. It is hard to imagine anything else in this world that could project more power for less size, weight, matter, and money than a thermonuclear bomb. Yet it's hard to imagine anything else in this world that could be more costly to agrarian civilization than thermonuclear warfare. Such is the paradox of kinetic power projection. If you get too efficient at it, it becomes too inefficient. The author calls this phenomenon the kinetic ceiling and illustrates it on Figure 56. Evolution of physical power projection technologies developed by agrarian society. Section 4.12.2. Kinetic stalemates don't create peace. They create major systemic security hazards. Sapiens could be described as an Icarus-like species who tried to outsmart natural selection and got burned. In their quest for efficiency, they made themselves inefficient. They tried to avoid the energy expenditure of using physical power as the basis for settling their disputes and establishing their pecking order, only to end up using much larger and costly quantities of physical power as the basis for settling their disputes and establishing their pecking order. Humans chased after more efficient power projection technologies for more than 10,000 years, only to build the most inefficient power projection technology possible. In their hubris, sapiens brought agrarian society to the brink of nuclear wars that cannot produce a winner. And now, they have cornered themselves by running straight into a kinetic ceiling. They appear to have scaled kinetic physical conflict to the point where it is no longer practically useful as a basis for settling their disputes and establishing a pecking order. They do not appear to understand how systemically hazardous this stalemate is. We have scaled our capacity to project kinetic power and compete in global scale kinetic power competitions beyond the point where it would be practically useful as a basis for settling disputes and establishing pecking order. It is possible that agrarian society is in the middle of a strategic level kinetic stalemate. Incidentally, the 70 years of time that have passed since the invention of nuclear warfare is just enough time for sapiens to forget the hard-earned lessons of history and the root causes of warfare discussed throughout this chapter. That peace, that temporary block of reprieve between wars, appears to be stretching towards its limit. We may be overdue for a strategic scale war, but what happens if a strategic scale kinetic war cannot be waged or cannot produce a winner? Is a strategic scale nuclear kinetic stalemate a good thing or a bad thing? The knee-jerk reaction from someone who doesn't understand the necessity of physical power projection in agrarian society would probably assert that nuclear stalemate is a good thing. Finally, they might claim, we can have peace because we have made strategic-level kinetic warfare too expensive to wage. Now that we have reached the end of this chapter on power projection dynamics in modern agrarian society, the reader should have a thorough understanding of the flaws of this line of reasoning. For starters, it presumes that the only threat to a population is invasion from a neighboring abstract power hierarchy. A strategic level stalemate might secure a population against an invasion from a neighboring abstract power hierarchy, but it wouldn't secure a population against massive scale systemic exploitation and abuse from their own abstract power hierarchy. So right out of the gate, people are ignoring a major security hazard and a reoccurring cause of war. This is why the author dedicated so much of this chapter to explaining the security flaws of abstract power hierarchies, to help the reader understand the threats they would likely face in a kinetic stalemate. Peace is not an option so long as predators exist, especially systemic predators who hunt people through their collective belief systems. Peace has never been a replacement to war. It has only been a name we assign to the state of reprieve between wars, when people are competent and trustworthy enough with their abstract powers to settle our disputes, manage our resources, and establish our pecking order without physical power. But as 10,000 years of evidence would suggest, peace doesn't last. It is as fleeting and as fragile as the imaginary power it gives to high-ranking people and entrusts them not to abuse. Like clockwork, our abstract power hierarchies become dysfunctional, and the next war comes. No species, to include sapiens, have ever walked the earth without subscribing to the physical power projection game. We have never had the option of unsubscribing from this game. We are not special because we have big brains capable of imagining a different world where we have outsmarted natural selection and aren't constantly under threat of being attacked, invaded, or exploited. No matter what our imaginations show us, the real world remains filled with these threats. We have never walked on a planet that isn't filled with predators. We have only allowed ourselves to forget about them. We become so comfortable and complacent in our high tower of success, built for us by the sacrifice of our predecessors, that we become docile and domesticated. We get drunk off the luxury of forgetting that we're surrounded by predators who don't take reprieves. We may be able to stop predators from invading us, but we can't stop predators from exploiting our belief systems. In particular, the belief systems we use to manage our most valuable resources, like our money. The more abstract power and control authority we give to a ruling class, the more benefit they gain from exploiting their abstract power and control authority over us. To expect a ruling class not to exploit increasingly asymmetric levels of abstract power is frankly ignorant. We know that this is incontrovertibly true, because if it weren't true, people wouldn't be compelled to fight wars. Their abstract power hierarchies and the imaginary logical constraints they encode into their rules of law would be sufficient to secure themselves without physical power. But it clearly isn't sufficient. Hence, warfare. So what happens when agrarian society hits a kinetic ceiling and stalemates itself at a strategic level? To believe that a stalemate is a good thing is to make a tacit assumption that there are viable alternatives to physical power as a basis for settling our strategic disputes, establishing control authority over our strategic resources, and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of our property in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way. Is it possible that sapiens are the first species on Earth to have discovered an alternative to physical power competition as the basis for establishing pecking order? Perhaps, but it seems more likely that the people who think a strategic level stalemate is a good thing are ignoring the core concepts of natural selection, human metacognition, and the differences between abstract and physical power. The point of view that a strategic level stalemate is good for agrarian society hinges on a delusion that sapiens have the option of living in a world without predators and entropy. It implies we can use our imaginations to adopt belief systems where people can be entrusted not to use their imaginary power to exploit our belief systems. It implies we can keep ourselves secure against systemic exploitation and abuse using nothing more than logical constraints encoded into rules of law to which systemic predators aren't sympathetic. For these and the reasons discussed at length throughout this chapter, it's unreasonable to believe that a kinetic stalemate represents a lasting peace. Instead, it's far more reasonable to believe that a kinetic stalemate represents a major systemic security hazard. Section 4.12.3. A stalemate to war would represent a god-king's paradise. To improve our own capacity to survive and prosper, it is vital for us to understand that there is no such thing as a substitute to physical power as a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian basis for settling disputes and establishing pecking order, no matter how much people like to preach about alternatives. If it's true that agrarian society has stalemated itself at a global-scale strategic level with nuclear warheads, then that means agrarian society has never been more vulnerable to the threat of unimpeachable systemic exploitation and abuse than it has ever been in the past 10,000 years of populations suffering from the oppression of their god-kings. To understand the hazard we could be in, simply ask, what are the complex emergent social benefits of warfare that society would lose in a kinetic stalemate? The author has already enumerated these benefits, but to summarize the top four, 1. Zero trust, permissionless, and egalitarian control over resources. 2. The ability to physically resist, constrain, and decentralize dysfunctional abstract power hierarchies. 3. The existential motivation to innovate and cooperate at increasingly higher scales. And 4. The ability to vector limited resources to the strongest and most intelligent members of the pack, who are demonstrably the best suited to survive in a world filled with predators and entropy. If these are the valid benefits of warfare, then we can see that a stalemated society would be a trust-based, thus systemically insecure, permission-based, and inegalitarian society, where a ruling class has unimpeachable control over a ruled class. A stalemated society would have no capacity to use kinetic power to physically constrain people from adopting a single ruling class to settle all their disputes, manage all their resources, and determine ownership of all their property. A stalemated society would have no existential motivators to cooperate at higher levels than the level required to maintain their stalemate. A stalemated society would have no way to identify who among them is demonstrably capable of navigating chaos and surviving in a world filled with predators and entropy. A stalemated society would have successfully mitigated the threat of invasion by neighboring abstract power hierarchies, only to make themselves far more exploitable by their own abstract power hierarchy. A global agrarian society locked in a strategic level kinetic stalemate would necessarily have to adopt belief systems which utilize abstract power to settle their disputes, manage their resources, and establish their pecking order, because they would have lost the option of using physical power to accomplish this in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way. To establish a global pecking order, the entire population would necessarily have to adopt a single abstract power hierarchy, and give a single ruling class extraordinary amounts of abstract power and control authority over them. And then, the whole world would have to trust that single ruling class, not to exploit them, because they would be physically powerless to stop it at a strategic level. Hopefully, now the reader can understand why the author spent so much time discussing the power dynamics of modern agrarian society. These dynamics help us understand why modern agrarian society may have entered an unprecedentedly hazardous state after the invention of nuclear warfare and policies like mutually assured destruction. Without the ability to physically constrain and decentralize abstract power hierarchies, society would lose its means to physically secure itself against global-scale exploitation and abuse by a single, tyrannical ruling class. All it would take for a tiny percentage of the population to gain completely centralized and unimpeachable control authority over the rest of the global population would be for high-ranking people inside nuclear-armed nations to collude within and between other nuclear-armed nations. Neo-oppressors would be able to exploit the world's belief systems without penalty, because the rest of the global population would no longer have the practical means to make it impossible to justify the physical cost of exploiting them. In other words, a kinetic stalemate between different nuclear-armed nations would also represent a kinetic stalemate between the ruled and ruling classes of those nations. In addition to making it too impractical to fight a strategic war between nuclear-armed nations, a stalemate could also make it too impractical to fight a civil or revolutionary war within nuclear-armed nations. If an incompetent, belligerent, or self-serving group of systemic predators were to regulatorily capture the abstract power granted to them within these nuclear-armed hierarchies, there might not be a practical way for citizens to escape their exploitation the same way they have always done in the past, by summing together their kinetic physical power to make it too physically costly to continue exploiting them. In this kind of situation, an oppressed populace would always be trapped in a trust-based, permission-based, and inegalitarian system where a ruling class must always be trusted not to exploit their abstract power, simply because the population is otherwise physically powerless to countervail them. To put it in plain terms, a strategically stalemated populace would be a god-king's paradise. The population would be backed into a corner where they would have to rely on people with abstract power to settle their disputes and establish their pecking order for them. They would have to adopt global-scale abstract power hierarchy to establish a global-scale pecking order, tacitly giving one ruling class more asymmetric abstract power and resource control authority than any ruling class has ever achieved. The global human population would have no choice but to trust their rulers not to exploit their abstract power, because they would otherwise have no practical means to physically countervail them. Section 4.12.4. Non-nuclear kinetic warfare can lead to non-nuclear kinetic stalemate. After hitting the kinetic ceiling with strategic nuclear warheads, society appears to be attempting to back themselves out of a corner by turning to non-nuclear kinetic warfare. The Korean War, Vietnam War, and the Global War on Terror are some examples of nuclear superpowers deliberately choosing to use weaker and less efficient power projection technologies to settle their disputes. Why would nuclear superpowers deliberately choose to use weaker and less efficient power projection technologies? Because it might be the only way kinetic power can still be useful as a basis for settling disputes and establishing pecking order. In other words, non-nuclear kinetic power might be the only way that a kinetic war can still have winners. Similar to the emergence of the idea of nation-states, kinetic warfare in the age of strategic nuclear warheads is another one of those situations where it is still too early to know how useful it will be as a mechanism for agrarian society to continue solving their disputes, managing their resources, and establishing their pecking order in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way. The results so far appear to be inconclusive. No two nuclear superpowers have gone head-to-head with each other in physical combat to settle a meaningful dispute. Instead, they have fought proxy wars, for example, Cold Wars and trade wars. Since the invention of strategic nuclear warheads and the adoption of policies like mutually assured destruction, non-kinetic warfare has only been used to settle minor disputes in comparison to kinetic wars of the past. These disputes have ostensibly been between non-nuclear nations or asymmetrically powerful nations where one side has nukes and the other side doesn't. This means we essentially have no idea if kinetic warfare is useful at solving large-scale property or policy disputes between nuclear superpowers anymore, because we have not tried it yet. The author has a difficult time believing that non-nuclear kinetic warfare could settle a major global-scale dispute between nuclear superpowers without escalating to nuclear warfare and once again stalemating it at some derivative form of mutually assured destruction. If we assume this is true, then we can conclude that society has indeed reached a kinetic stalemate at both the nuclear and non-nuclear level, and is therefore highly vulnerable to the systemic security hazards discussed throughout this chapter. But for the sake of argument, if we were to assume that it is still possible to settle major global-scale strategic disputes using non-nuclear kinetic warfare, then the author asserts it's not reasonable to believe this capability will last for long. If there's still a window of opportunity for kinetic warfare to be useful as a means to settle major strategic disputes, then that window of opportunity might be closing. As mentioned before, sapiens are obsessed with efficiency. Nuclear warheads represent what happens when sapiens create more efficient power projection technologies. They design and build power projection technologies that are so efficient they aren't practically useful. Nuclear warheads prove that too much power projection efficiency can counterintuitively become too inefficient. It's clearly possible to build power projection technologies that are so efficient at projecting power that they're too costly to use because of how destructive they are. With this in mind, consider what it means when agrarian society deliberately chooses to settle their disputes and establish their pecking order using non-nuclear technologies. It means they're going to strive to make their non-nuclear kinetic power projection technology more efficient. What is the end state of making non-nuclear kinetic power projection technologies more efficient? We already know what the end state is. Eventually, non-nuclear kinetic power projection technology will become too efficient to be practically useful. By deliberately choosing to withhold from nuclear warfare and engage in non-nuclear kinetic warfare as the primary basis for settling global disputes in a zero-trust and permissionless way, agrarian society is setting itself up for a situation where it discovers yet another way to make kinetic warfare too costly to wage. Instead of nuclear technology, it would just be some other non-nuclear technology that becomes too efficient at projecting power to be practically useful. The way things are starting to play out, it looks like it could be something involving artificial intelligence and swarms of flying, crawling, and swimming drones. If we can return to the chart showing the evolution of power projection technologies employed by agrarian society, we can illustrate this issue by adding another arrow to the chart, as shown in Figure 57, Evolution of Physical Power Projection Technology, shown with an attempted fork. By choosing to engage in non-nuclear forms of kinetic warfare, agrarian society is essentially trying to fork its evolutionary path. The problem is that the forked path is just as vulnerable into running into the same kinetic ceiling. The end state of increasingly more efficient kinetic power projection technologies is the same, regardless of whether it's nuclear or non-nuclear, a kinetic stalemate. All that agrarian society will accomplish by forking the evolutionary path of kinetic power projection is to eventually discover yet another way that kinetic wars can't be won because it's too costly to wage, creating yet another form of mutually assured destruction that leads to the same kinetic stalemate, possibly at both the strategic and the tactical level. Nations have started to realize that the best way to make their non-nuclear kinetic power projection technologies more efficient at projecting power is to take humans out of the loop. Software-operated drones are replacing human-operated machines. The size, weight, and power of these drones are collapsing. They're starting to fly in swarms. They're starting to drop bombs on people's heads with extraordinary precision. They're starting to think for themselves and predict human behavior better than humans can. The marginal cost of putting precisely the right amount of kinetic power in precisely the right place to impose the maximum amount of physical cost on attackers is plummeting, thanks to drones. We're getting extremely good at kinetically striking people with surgical-like precision for cheap. At the same time, other technologies like artificial intelligence are converging. We are marching straight towards the dystopian future envisioned by the Wachowskis in The Matrix, where swarms of sentient killer robots patrol the skies over the ruins of their creators. Mutually assured destruction was the byproduct of the collapsing marginal cost of kinetic power projection technology, following the discovery of nuclear technology. The more the marginal cost of projecting kinetic power decreases, the easier it becomes for multiple nations to scale it. But this same dynamic applies to non-nuclear technology too. The easier it is to scale non-nuclear kinetic power projection technologies, the easier it becomes for society to reach the kinetic ceiling again, and once again arrive at the point where our kinetic power projection technology becomes too mutually devastating to be practically useful as a method for solving disputes. Human society cannot be safe from the threat of mutually assured destruction merely by switching to a non-nuclear form of kinetic warfare, because switching to a non-nuclear form of kinetic warfare doesn't do anything to address what caused mutually assured destruction to happen in the first place. The collapsing marginal cost of kinetic power projection caused by the discovery of new technologies. So even if we assume that non-nuclear kinetic wars between peers can still be conclusively won, which is already a tall assumption to make considering the track record of kinetic conflicts which have taken place after the invention of nuclear warheads, then we still have to acknowledge that the most that can be gained for our species from non-nuclear kinetic warfighting is temporary and incremental advantages along an evolutionary path of technology development that point toward the same dead end. Pun intended. Restructuring a military to win non-nuclear kinetic warfighting campaigns could represent an act of optimizing a military for a local maximum, not a global maximum. The end state of that effort is potentially a stalemate between nations at both the strategic and tactical levels, using both nuclear and non-nuclear technology. The key takeaway from this thought exercise is that there is essentially no way for agrarian society to escape from the bounded prosperity trap of a kinetic stalemate. All we can do is keep forking the evolution of our kinetic power projection technologies to buy ourselves small windows of time to settle disputes and establish pecking order in a zero-trust and permissionless way before we discover yet another way to mutually assure our own destruction. Section 4.12.5. Non-kinetic, in other words, electric, power competitions could enable mutually assured preservation. Now we finally arrive at a core insight about human physical power projection tactics, which is essential for understanding the potential national strategic implications of Bitcoin. As much as people wish for it, there can be no peace, because peace requires a world without predators, a world which doesn't exist. Consequently, if we stalemate ourselves with kinetic warfare, we don't create an environment without predators, so we don't get peace. Instead, we create a huge window of opportunities for predators to exploit us through our belief systems at unprecedented scale because they cannot be physically challenged or overthrown. A stalemate forces people into adopting abusive and exploitative abstract power hierarchies teeming with corruption because people lose the option of settling their disputes and establishing their pecking order in a zero-trust and egalitarian way using physical power. And if society tries to fork the evolution of kinetic power projection technology into a non-nuclear direction, they aren't going to solve the paradox of kinetic power projection. They are just going to discover another path to mutually assured destruction, and find themselves stuck in the same bounded prosperity trap we're already stuck in, with the exact same systemic security vulnerabilities. The most that can be gained from continuing down the kinetic path could be minor victories against asymmetrically weak nations, perhaps not major strategic victories against nuclear peers. How does society escape from this trap? Nature offers an idea. Antlers. We need a technology that will allow us to continue to use physical power as the basis for settling our disputes, managing our resources, and establishing our pecking order in a zero-trust and permissionless way, while still keeping ourselves systemically secure by empowering us to impose severe physical costs on our attackers. But we need a way to do this that either minimizes or eliminates intraspecies fratricide. To accomplish this, we need a different, non-kinetic form of physical power projection technology that allows us to engage in global-scale physical power competitions in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way, but non-lethally and non-destructively. It needs to be a power projection technology that will not become increasingly impractical to use as people become increasingly more efficient at projecting physical power and imposing severe physical costs on their neighbors. This new form of physical power projection technology should never become too efficient to be practically useful. Therefore, it won't suffer from the same fundamental flaw of kinetic power projection technology, no matter how efficient we try to make it. Using this new type of non-kinetic physical power projection technology, a kinetically stalemated society could continue along their path to technological evolution without having to worry about hitting a kinetic ceiling. While maintaining the kinetic stalemate, a society could continue to chase after an infinite prosperity margin for themselves by maximizing their cost of attack and minimizing their BCRA. This would allow them to keep themselves secure against both foreign invasion and domestic exploitation by making it impossible to justify the physical cost of attacking or exploiting them, no matter how efficient they make their power projection technology, and no matter how much physical power they project. Here we uncover a remarkable idea. The future of global-scale strategic warfighting is more likely to be an electronic form of warfare rather than a kinetic form of warfare. Why? For the simple reason that kinetic warfare is literally a dead end for agrarian society. With the invention of nuclear warheads, it is possible that agrarian society has already stalemated itself by unlocking a kinetic path to mutually assured destruction, where wars can't be conclusively won, and disputes can't be conclusively settled. There might be very little to gain by identifying yet another kinetic path to mutually assured destruction, where wars continue to be unwinnable and disputes continue to be unsettleable using kinetic technology. And that's assuming it's still even possible to fight strategic conflicts with nuclear peers that don't escalate to the nuclear level, which the author highly doubts. Forking the evolutionary path of kinetic power projection tactics, techniques, and technologies to pursue non-nuclear options isn't going to change the direction of this 10,000-plus-year trend. Agrarian society is still marching towards another form of kinetic stalemate. And that's assuming we make the assumption that we aren't already there. Instead, the future of warfare seems to be a non-kinetic form of global physical power competitions that can continue evolving in the same direction as other physical power projection technologies, up and to the right, without running into a kinetic ceiling where it becomes too lethal or destructive to be practically useful. The future of warfare seems like it will be the kind of physical competition that can actually be won, so that our property and policy disputes can actually be settled. Otherwise, it's not really the future of warfare. It's just the continuation of the same stalemate we could be in right now. The key to winning future wars seems to be finding the battlefield where battles can still be fought and won, no matter how powerful and efficient Sapiens make their power projection technologies. And clearly, that's cyberspace. The future battlefield of national-scale warfare could be an electro-cyber battlefield, where nations impose severe physical costs on each other electronically rather than kinetically. This concept is shown in Figure 58, Evolution of Physical Power Projection Technology, shown with non-kinetic end state. In this future, nations could increasingly rely on soft forms of non-kinetic power projection that involve charges passing across resistors, as opposed to exclusively relying on hard forms of warfare that involve forces displacing masses. Of course, hard war would still exist, but perhaps mostly to settle minor tactical disputes or to preserve the kinetic stalemate caused by the kinetic power paradox discussed in the previous section. To put it simply, if Sapiens are going to evolve antlers so they can continue to engage in global power competitions to settle property and policy disputes and establish pecking order in a zero-trust and egalitarian way that can't be kinetically stalemated, it seems highly likely they're going to be electronic antlers. Electric power projection technology would allow a population to keep themselves physically secure against systemic predators, for example, oppression, without having to rely on the faulty encoded logic of their laws, while a kinetic stalemate would continue to keep them physically secure against foreign invaders. The resulting electric power competition would preserve a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way for settling disputes, determining who gets control over resources, and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of property. Section 4.12.6. Nikola Tesla already predicted this would eventually happen. This idea isn't new. It's actually more than a century old. Tesla predicted this in his essay entitled The Problem of Increasing Human Energy. He first described the kinetic power projection paradox in 1900. He already saw the potential for kinetic power projection to scale to the point where it would no longer be useful as a basis for engaging in physical disputes. As one of the world's leading experts in electricity at the time, he also saw how electronic warfare could one day replace kinetic warfare. He predicted society would hit a ceiling with its large and clumsy kinetic power projection technologies, and be forced out of existential necessity to evolve towards human-out-of-the-loop, global-scale, machine-on-machine warfare. And he saw this all before the invention of cars, tanks, airplanes, aerial bombardment, nuclear bombs, and drones. In his words, quote, "What is the next phase in this evolution? Not peace as yet, by any means. The next change which should naturally follow from modern developments should be the continuous diminution of the number of individuals engaged in battle. The apparatus will be one of specifically great power, but only a few individuals will be required to operate it. This evolution will bring more and more into prominence a machine with the fewest individuals as the element of warfare, and the absolute unavoidable consequence of this will be the abandonment of large, clumsy, slowly moving, and unmanageable units. Greatest possible speed and maximum rate of energy delivery by the war apparatus will be the main object. The loss of life will become smaller and smaller, and finally, the number of the individuals continuously diminishing. Merely machines will meet in a contest without bloodshed, the nations being simply interested, ambitious spectators. When this happy condition is realized, peace will be assured." End quote. Here we can see Tesla predicting that people would develop power projection technologies capable of projecting great power, but simultaneously requiring less human-in-the-loop operation. This assertion is followed by another assertion that peace wouldn't be possible if these power projection technologies caused bloodshed. He claims that mutually assured peace would only be feasible if these power-projecting machines did battle against each other via an energy competition. Otherwise, power-projection technologies would become too savage and destructive. His prediction aligns to what was outlined in this section, that nations would run into kinetic stalemates and not be able to achieve mutually assured peace until they settled on a way to fight their wars non-kinetically, in a way that eliminates bloodshed and mutually assures the preservation of human life, no matter how powerful it becomes. Quote, "No matter to what degree of perfection rapid-fire guns, high-powered cannons, explosive projectiles, torpedo boats, or other implements of war may be brought, no matter how destructive they may be made, that condition of assured peace can never be reached through any such development. Their object is to kill and to destroy. To break this fierce spirit, a radical departure must be made. An entirely new principle must be introduced, something that never existed before in warfare, a principle which will forcibly, unavoidably, turn the battle into a mere spectacle, a play, a contest, without loss of blood." End quote. If we combine the core concepts provided in this chapter with Tesla's insights, then we get to the following argument. The way for agrarian society to assure a lasting peace between nations is not to keep building increasingly more efficient kinetic power projection technologies, which do nothing but win small victories and identify new ways to place ourselves into situations where wars can't be won because they're too lethal and destructive. Instead, the way to assure lasting peace between nations is to give nations the means to engage in non-kinetic, in other words, electronic, global warfare with each other. To that end, it is reasonable to believe that nations will continue to compete against each other in global-scale physical power competitions to settle their disputes and establish pecking order in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way. But they will learn how to do it increasingly more electronically rather than kinetically. They will extend the battlefield into a new domain, where battles can still be won, and where people can still physically secure the resources they value. And because this new form of warfare is electric, thus non-lethal, the world might reach a state of peace it has never known in 10,000 years of kinetic warfare. In other words, to achieve global peace, simply swap out some of society's kinetic warfighting technologies with electric warfighting technologies, where it would be effective to do so. Maybe the best way to eliminate war is not to try to eliminate it all, but instead to make war soft. A key to a sustainable peace that is safe against systemic predators could be some form of electronic, non-lethal warfare. Whereas kinetic power competitions lead to mutually assured destruction and stalemates that place society in a systemically vulnerable pickle where they can be systemically exploited through their belief systems at unprecedented scale by people with abstract power, electric power competitions lead to mutually assured preservation. Electric power makes it possible to settle disputes, establish control authority over resources, and achieve consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of property in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way that can't be exploited by people wielding imaginary power. All that needs to be done to keep people's valuable resources, like bits of information, to include financial information, physically secure against both foreign invasion and internal corruption, is to maintain the kinetic stalemate while utilizing an electronic form of physical power projection. That way, people can impose severe physical costs on all forms of attackers. Einstein's theories support Tesla's theories. Einstein theorized that matter is swappable with energy. If that's true, then instead of fighting wars by blasting people with projectiles, we should be able to blast them with energy in a non-kinetically destructive manner and get similar emergent properties. In this case, the emergent property is physical security. A watt of physical power is a watt of physical power, regardless of whether it's generated using forces displacing masses or charges passing across resistors. It should therefore be possible to replicate the emergent properties of kinetic warfare and settle global-scale physical conflicts using an energy-based or soft form of global power competition, rather than a mass-based or hard form of global power competition. The only question is, how? In Tesla's mind, the answer was by creating intelligent machines. In his words, quote, "To bring on this result, men must be dispensed with. Machine must fight machine. But how to accomplish that which seems impossible? The answer is simple enough. Produce a machine capable of acting as though it were part of a human being. A machine embodying a higher principle, which will enable it to perform its duties as though it had intelligence, experience, judgment, a mind." End quote. Tesla made this prediction more than 40 years before the invention of the first operational general-purpose computer. He died a year before it was built, as well as 2 years before the first successful detonation of a nuclear warhead. Already admired by history as one of the world's greatest scientific minds, these predictions may one day make Tesla famous for also being a military strategic thinker. Tesla essentially predicted that software would lead to soft war, before either computers or nuclear warheads were invented, that a lasting peace could be achieved if agrarian society could figure out a way to wage wars by having their machines battle other machines using great sums of energy, and humans watched eagerly from the sidelines. If we assume Tesla's predictions will eventually come true, then humankind has one extremely important question it needs to answer as quickly as possible before they reach the next non-nuclear form of mutually assured destruction. What would a global-scale electronic power competition look like, where machines battled machines in a non-lethal way, and humans watched from the sidelines? In other words, what would agrarian society's electronic antlers look like?